Hello, and welcome to episode 31 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Today on the podcast, I am very pleased to welcome Dr. Robin Bloom, Associate Professor at the Department of Philosophy and Lyman Briggs College at Michigan State University, as well as a member of the Neurogenderings Network. Robin's research examines philosophical issues in neuroscience and in medicine, with a particular focus on the relationship between ethical and epistemological questions in these areas. Robin has written extensively on the philosophy of evidence-based practice, as well as the use of functional neuroimaging in psychiatry. Robin is currently a co-editor of Neurofeminism: Issues at the Intersection of Feminist Theory and Cognitive Science. Thus, without further ado, let's bring in Robin. Dr. Robin Bloom, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this morning?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. How is the Michigan State? Is it? How's the weather out there?
Well, it's surprisingly sunny, actually. We tend to have pretty gray winters, but it's quite nice. I'm actually looking forward to going outside.
Oh, that's very nice. And what city is that in
currently? It's East Lansing.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Sort of right in the middle of the lower part of the state.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And how long have you been teaching and doing research there?
Since fall 2015, so this is my third year.
Oh, great. So, yeah, had you ever been to Michigan before?
I had been to St. Joseph's and Benton Harbor once to visit a friend's sister.
Okay.
And then I was actually here in East Lansing the first time I had an interview at Michigan State.
Oh.
So those were my only two visits.
Interesting. Oh, great. I'm glad to hear, interested to hear the story. Okay. Well, yeah. Well, glad to hear. And is the semester winding down okay?
It's going well. Yeah. I'm ready for the break, but it's been a good semester.
Great. Great. Did you end up teaching anything fun this term?
So half of my appointment is in Lyman Briggs College, which is an undergraduate college for science students that builds philosophy and social studies of science into the curriculum. So for the first time, I'm teaching the introductory course, and I realized that I couldn't possibly be all things to all the students, so I taught it more or less as a philosophy of science class, and it's been a lot of fun.
Great. Oh, that's really interesting. What was kind of like the initial sort of framing of it? What is it initially set to be?
There's a large number of people who teach the class, and we all tend to do it our own way. We impose any sort of uniformity on it, though.
Oh, great.
If you look at people's syllabi, there's a lot of similarity. I actually stole an idea from my philosophy colleague, Michael O'Rourke, who runs the Toolbox Dialogue Project. He does a lot of work with interdisciplinary science teams, having them articulate their often implicit understandings of science and of philosophical questions in science. And I created a questionnaire for my students that tried to pick up on some of those themes, and they completed it at the beginning of the year, and then we checked in a couple of times and they redid the questionnaire and talked about how and why their views have changed.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, it's been really great to see what they're taking from the course.
This is fantastic. I hadn't heard about this dialogue initiative. So, yeah, thank you for turning me on to this. This is really...
take a look. It's really fascinating work.
Fantastic. Well, I'm excited to talk about your current work and current teaching, which sounds very exciting. But let's take a step back and start back at the beginning. So, Robin, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada.
Okay.
So Hamilton is, when I was growing up, it was probably about 400,000 to 500,000. I'm not quite sure how big it is now, but it's essentially part of the major metropolitan area that stretches through and past Toronto.
Oh, and I see. West of Toronto?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right on the, it's the, I guess the Hamilton Harbor is sort of the and off of Lake Ontario or part of Lake Ontario.
Very nice. Very nice. Beautiful, beautiful. And okay. And so you grew up there. Were you there majority of childhood years? Or
All of my childhood years. In fact, my parents are still living in the house I grew up in. So.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Remarkably stable or remarkably boring, depending on how you look at it.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. And what were your parents up to growing up? What did dad and mom do?
My father was a painter, a house painter, not an art painter, though he actually is also a very talented artist. And since he's retired, he's been painting. He gets some antique milk cans and saws and pots, clay pots, and paints scenes on those.
Oh, wow.
But it was all houses all the time when I was growing up. And my mother was a bookkeeper. She worked for a while for an engineering company and then for an accountant. And then for most of the time, she was the bookkeeper for a law firm.
Oh, great. Great. Painting and bookkeeping. So as a child, did you get to do any of these activities as a kid? Interested in painting homes or bookkeeping?
I was not allowed to paint as a child. My dad is a perfectionist. In fact, when I moved back to Hamilton to do my master's at McMaster, I rented an apartment and my dad came and helped me paint and actually allowed me to help. So the first thing I got to do was paint the part of the wall in the kitchen that the refrigerator was going to sit in front of. And that went so well, I got to do the bottom coat in the hallway.
Wow. How generous.
Well, actually, it went awfully generous because he did the vast majority of the work.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
I just provided moral support.
Well, that's really, yeah, okay. Well, you
and
know.
And he said I did a good job.
That's fantastic then. That's really supportive. And okay. Well, so what was it like, your experience growing up in Hamilton, just east, southwest of Ontario? What were some of your interests? How did you spend your days?
I was, I guess, sort of a stereotypically nerdy kid. I read a lot. I skipped a grade, so I was a year younger than most of the other people in my class, and I am asthmatic and remarkably uncoordinated. So I tended to be the kid off to the side reading rather than the one playing sports or
doing
the active things.
What kind of things did you like to read?
Well, I mean, as a kid, I guess the short answer is just about anything. As a kid, I read, mostly children's books, young adult fiction. I didn't really start developing any sort of more interesting tastes until well into high school. I was a kind of kid who would be sitting at the kitchen table reading the cereal box if there was nothing else to read.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, as a kid, of course, it's all about those fun series and fiction series geared for kids.
Right.
Definitely. Okay. That's great. So what about, reading, doing anything else? Did you, start taking an interest in particular studies in high school or middle school or about that time?
So I always sort of gravitated towards, I guess, more humanities subjects. I really enjoyed English class and history, and I took a lot of languages. So as much as I could, I suppose. I mean, being Canadian, French is the obvious second language to be studying. So I did that, and German, and I also managed to get in 1 year of Latin.
Oh, wow. Okay. And I'm sorry I didn't ask you this before. I'll come back to it. But what was it like? You're grown up as Canadian. What's your experience and a reflection on growing up in Canada?
I don't know. I guess I don't really have much of a basis for comparison.
Oh, sure, sure.
I think in general Canadian culture is fairly influenced by U.S. culture. So, we always got TV from Buffalo and New York and all of the networks and stuff. And it actually still surprises me occasionally where when I find out that something that I knew was a Canadian thing and that a lot of people who grew up in the U.S. are not familiar with it.
So, right. Do you have an example of that or of something?
So I guess really nothing off the top of my head in terms of like the things that I would mostly have been thinking about at the time would be music. But even just things like junk food and terminology. So I remember finding out that pencil crayons is actually a Canadian term and that my American colleagues had no idea what they were. Actually, they ended up, some of them guessing it's colored pencils. But, you know, things like this that were perfectly normal for me that I didn't really think of as being particularly Canadian.
Are they colored pencils or are they just something different?
They are pencil crayons. Yes. And now you know.
I'm sorry. They're colored pencils.
Yes. Yeah.
But pencil crayons. I mean, they are essentially crayons, which is like, vegetable colored pencils. But you're right. Yeah. We grew up with crayons, which have a particular width and thickness, of course. No, no, that's not true. But colored pencils. Okay, cool. Cool. All right. So you were studying some humanities subjects. What was it about the humanities that drew you in?
I just really enjoyed them. I did take some science and some math classes and they were fine, but I just had more interest in, I mean, because I really enjoyed reading, I guess the English courses in particular were a natural fit. And I really liked learning languages and sort of thinking about, you know, not in a formal grammatical way, but the different ways that ideas were expressed in different languages and the different kinds of terms and the relationships in words in different languages.
And so, yeah, so you French, Canadian, and Latin were those languages with which you were interested?
French and German, and then just
German
of Latin.
Okay. Great. Okay. Were you part of any of the clubs or anything in high school, like the French or Latin club or anything?
I was not really much of a joiner.
That's fair. Understandable, yeah. Okay. Well, cool. Well, so, you know, so in this time, was, you know, philosophy on the radar at all? Philosophy of science or, you know, what, I suppose, no. A bigger question, in high school, what did you want to be when you grew up?
So I wanted to be a writer, which was kind of a vague, I thought I was going to write a novel or something like that. And then as I got a little older, I was thinking about journalism. But by the time I was actually getting ready to apply to university, I decided that I wanted to do translation. So that's actually what I ended up starting out as a major.
And by translation, so in what particular field would you go into if you were doing that? It's not
so professional translation. So, more, written translation than, interpretation, so simultaneous interpretation. My French was not strong enough for that, but I thought that I could translate written documents. And then it turned out that I did my undergraduate degree at Laurentian University, which is in Sudbury, Ontario, which is a bilingual town and a bilingual school. Oh. And I realized that all the people who were actually Francophone were going to get all the jobs.
Jeez.
Yes. Growing up in Hamilton and doing well in French class is not the same thing as being bilingual.
When it really comes to it, they want that specificity. Or is it more just like a preference, you think?
I just don't think I would have been terribly competitive for jobs. I think I had maybe done a couple of years of immersion and gone and lived in Quebec or gone and lived in France, I would have had more of a chance, but I also didn't feel confident enough that it was, you know, going to pay off if I did that.
Sure. And so, yeah. So, I mean, was this something where then, I guess, to work as a translator, I imagine, did you major in French or?
No, I actually majored in translation for a couple of years.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know that. I just haven't been as familiar and haven't met someone who's, this is great.
Yeah, I actually picked the course that I did because could start the translation degree in your first year, whereas the other places had a 1 year of a general arts, and then you could apply to the specialization. So I think the degree was actually a bachelor's in translation, a BTran.
Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at now, and other places have certificates in like the School of Words and Letters and different things. They're, translation's a very, it's a much more common, you know, program, either I imagine certificate or bachelor's. That's great. So going into school and then coming to understand that this might not be as what you wanted to do. Was this toward the end of your undergraduate career, or was this more toward the beginning?
I started to realize in first year that this was going to be an issue, and I was trying to think about alternatives.
Yeah.
I ended up doing a second year of the translation degree, but by that point I was already making plans to switch majors.
Okay. And what were you thinking at the time?
I worked in the library on campus my first couple of years when I was living in residence, mm-hmm. and there was one slow day that I was flipping through the course catalog, because back then it was actually a physical thing, and I was looking at possible majors, and they had a major in behavioral neuroscience, oh. and one of the courses for the fourth year in that program was called something like Behavior and the Electromagnetic and Biochemical Bases of Behavior.
Oh, and I thought, great.
Holy crap, I don't even know what that is. I'm going to take that class.
All right. How was your experience in introduction into neuroscience?
It was interesting. I had to go back. I did a couple of high school correspondence courses in science to see whether this was something that I really liked, because I'd taken chemistry but not biology or physics. So I did those, and then at the same time did, I think, introductory psychology at university and possibly introductory biology, something else, before I actually changed majors.
Sure.
And it was fun. It was very different. I had fairly small classes, and then suddenly I was in sort of the stereotypical first year science classes in the huge auditorium with all the lab sections, and mm-hmm. it was a big change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, at this time, did it kind of provide some sort of interest? Was this like, okay, now I want to go into the sciences, or...
Yeah, I had sort of planned to, I definitely wanted to finish the degree. That point wasn't thinking too far ahead in terms of a career or in terms of grad school, but I really, really liked the neuroscience classes and the biology more generally. I remember taking histology and just being fascinated by it, which, you know, just in retrospect, just seems like such an odd thing, because it's fairly dry and there's not a lot of theory or explanation. It's just, well, at least, you know, at the level that I was learning it.
Sure. I happened to take a neuroanatomy course my junior year, and there was something about, you know, it's not heavy on explanation at all, but there's something about the level. Oh, did we?
Sorry.
Oh, we might have lost you. Sorry. Okay, you're back. I was just going to say, in terms of like a base neuroanatomy or neuroscience basis of behavior, there's something about the learning that level of description which is particularly fascinating, especially having been exposed to it previously. Like there's almost like it has like there's this elusive promise. It promises the answers at first. Later on, you realize, oh wait, maybe not.
But there's something about a big fat textbook full of facts that just seems pretty impressive.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what I need to know. Great. Okay. So, all right. So, you know, doing some of these courses, did you formally switch your major to neuroscience?
I did. I think after my second year.
Okay. Great. And, all right. So, doing those neuros courses, so not too much on the radar, but what was taking place after undergrad? What were you thinking?
So I had at some point taken an intro philosophy class as an elective. And then in my final year of the neuroscience degree, when I was actually taking the course, I had no idea what to expect in. We read Gerald Adelman's book, The Remembered Present, which is consciousness. And I thought, yeah, you know, there's got to be more to the mind than this. I'm going to study philosophy. So I actually ended up doing a second undergraduate degree. At the time, you could do a three-year BA. And so I got some extra credits together and spent a year taking philosophy courses to get enough credits for the second degree.
Wow. Okay. And so I'm not particularly familiar with this book, but it's a biological theory of consciousness. Okay. So you took issue with the book?
I just thought there was something missing and I had no clue what it was. I don't think that, you know, I had a particularly devastating critique of his theory.
Sure.
I just felt like there was something that he wasn't actually getting at. And I don't even remember whether it was, you know, some sort of mystical longing for the ineffable or whether it was just that I didn't think he had a good argument or good data.
Yeah. Interesting. No, well, these are the kind of moments that, you know, strike someone to go into philosophy, I think. when you can't necessarily, especially in these early years, when you can't quite put your finger on particular inconsistency or a particular incompleteness, and then go on to pursue it the rest of your life. All right. So, okay. So going into philosophy, so doing the dual, how was your first then experience into philosophy?
It was a lot of fun. I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't really have a plan. My university was quite small, so I basically took the courses that were available, which ended up being a lot of dead German guys.
Yeah.
So my metaphysics class, we read Kant and Hegel and Fichte, and I had no idea that analytic metaphysics, for example, was even a thing.
Yeah. It doesn't get written about in the New York Times a lot.
Well, right. And I'm not sure I would have been reading the New York Times.
No.
But I did a philosophy of science class that I really liked. And what else did I do? I took ancient philosophy, which was a full year course. So I really enjoyed it.
Great.
I didn't actually, you know, find a theory of mind. There wasn't actually a philosophy of mind class to take. So that I guess sort of came later.
Sure. All right. So it sounds like you're on the road to philosophy of science. So what took place after undergrad? Were you thinking about graduate school, considering other options?
I was. I think, you know, when I think a lot of students in their last year don't really know what to do unless they're sort of on a professional track. They want to go to med school. They want to go to law school. So I think a lot of people do think that grad school is the next step. And I certainly was one of them. I didn't know whether I wanted to do grad school in the sciences or in philosophy. And I was leaning toward the sciences because I felt like it was a better career choice and that essentially you could make a contribution as a mediocre scientist in a way that, you know, you couldn't as a mediocre philosopher. So I guess I was sort of buying into the idea that the great philosophers are the great philosophers. And that was what I should be aspiring to if I was going to do it at all.
Interesting. So
relic of the dead German guys classes, I suppose.
Yeah, you get this idealization of these idealists and other folks, and you're just like, that's really an interesting thought. And I think I kind of resonate with that feeling, but I feel like, I mean, is that a position you now hold today?
No, not.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But right. You get this sense. It's like if you're not doing these, if you're not going to be remembered hundreds of years later in this particular way and having written this corpus of work, then, you know, only these individuals can really say something, which I think is, just an error and something that needs to, hopefully can be communicated to future philosophy students.
Right.
Okay, so were you applying for science courses, or excuse me, science grad programs, or?
I did. I applied to a few, and I didn't get in. And I think at one point I also made an effort and applied to med school, but didn't write the MCAT. And I sort of, you know, that was just sort of a, well, this is, I think, something that people do.
Of course, of course, yeah.
So, yeah, so I ended up after finishing the philosophy degree and the year that I applied for grad schools, I moved to Toronto and waitered and tried to figure out what I wanted to do with my life.
How was the serving profession?
It was terrible. I hated it.
It's good. It's good. Good to get the time in to serve. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that I did it. I think everybody should have to do that or something similar at some point in their life. But I just got so tired of walking up to tables with my big friendly smile and saying, "Hi, how are you today?" And
oh my God.
Oh, I'll have a Coke. So I have no patience for people who can't be bothered to try to be decent human beings.
Yeah, that's really difficult.
It was absolutely terrible. After a couple of years of that, I started taking classes part-time again at the University of Toronto, and that made it at least a little bit more bearable, but I still had no clue what I was doing or where I wanted to go. Yeah, so
understandable. It's tough, especially, you know, at these early times. I'm always impressed by folks who, it seems, have it all figured out at 19 or 20.
I tend now to assume that they're wrong and sooner or later. I know that there are people like that.
Sure. Yeah. But I think it's also good, to have this experience of trying to figure things out. And so obviously it sounded like things were better when you were in school or taking classes, which which I think for most of us is understandable. Considering science and med school, what happened next? Did you decide to give it a shot in philosophy or what was it?
So the first year I took classes, my thought was that I would improve my lab skills because I was a terrible, terrible chemist. My glassware was always dirty. My experiments never worked. I liked biology labs a little bit better, but I didn't think anybody was going to pay me to dissect frogs. So I thought I would go back and I would do sort of more molecular biology type labs and really improve those skills. And then I found out, looking at my course schedule, that I actually had enrolled in all of the classes that didn't have labs. So I decided to be a good behaviorist about it and draw the inference that I just didn't really want to do that. And I actually love those classes. I took one course on Drosophila neurogenetics and got to learn all about how flies are made by flies. And it was just fascinating seeing, you know, what some of the techniques and some of the theories were.
What did they do in the Drosophila neurogenetics
and
course?
I remember we actually just read a bunch of things. We didn't have, that was one of the classes with no labs. So I read, there's a book by Lawrence is the last name, called The Making of a Fly. And, it's very outdated now, but it's kind of a classic of development. I think, you know, there's probably very little genetics in that. It was more embryology at the time. But it was just really super cool. And actually in that class, I remember finding out, our final project was on what we weren't told, but was actually the Notch gene. And please don't ask me what that does, because I don't remember.
I remember learning about this. Yeah.
It does a bunch of things, including things really early in development. And I remember that this was something that my professor was working on. And then there was somebody at the University of Toronto Scarborough campus, which, you know, it was only a half hour car ride away in bad traffic, who was working on similar genes in the mouse. And I don't remember how I learned this, but I mentioned it to my professor and she didn't know. And I was thinking, wow, that's really weird. You know, there's all these scientists who are doing things and should know what each other's doing, but they're not communicating. And I found that really striking.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you make of that at the time? The idea that folks are, well, I guess there was this kind of lack of connection or communication among the scientists.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just that everybody's really busy and science is pretty specialized, and you know, read the stuff that you read, the journals that you read, you follow the research of the groups that are closest to you, and it can be really difficult to kind of have a big picture of what's going on. And I actually went and spoke with that professor at some point and said, you know, I don't think I want to be a scientist. What else, you know, can I do with a science degree? And she actually suggested law school, because this would have been sort of the mid to late 90s when all of the gene patenting stuff was really hot.
Right.
And I said, you know, what I really want. Love to do is write review articles, like just, you know, read all of this stuff and
get to learn about it.
And to sort of see how all the bits and pieces fit together. So, you know, again, kind of like dissecting frogs, I didn't think anyone was going to hire me just to do that. Mm-hmm. Though foreshadowing, I ended up being a little bit wrong about that. So after that year, I ended up going back and taking philosophy classes again. And I took philosophy of science and philosophy of mind. And that was really when I thought, yes, I definitely do want to go into philosophy.
Fantastic. Okay. And so, yeah, what you said, so what was next? The McMaster University?
So at the time in Canada, and I think this is changing a bit, it was pretty standard to do a master's before applying to PhD programs. There weren't a lot of direct entry PhDs. So I did a master's at Mac, I think six courses, and then a thesis over 2 years. And that was actually a lot of fun as well. At the time, they had a joint graduate program with the University of Guelph. So I got on the bus a couple of days a week and went to Guelph for classes. And I just basically took a bunch of different courses and really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. At the time, I mean, was, you know, philosophy of science, was that what you wanted to do, or did you want to be a philosopher? Or,
I thought more philosophy of mind. So that's what I wrote my master's thesis on, folk psychology and neuroscience. Yeah, and so that was still what I was thinking I wanted to do, because I thought it would be a good way of bringing together all of the science stuff. I had taken a philosophy of science class and liked it, but wasn't really thinking about being a philosopher of science at that point.
Sure.
So I think that happened at some point during my PhD.
Sure. Okay. And and did you like your time at McMaster?
I did. I had a really good time. I took a bunch of different courses, got sort of a broader sense of what philosophy was, and that I found really helpful. I also really liked graduate work. I have really fond memories of lying on the couch in my apartment and just reading for hours on it.
I bet. That's a lot.
I want those days back.
Oh, yeah. So there's so much more to do as the time. I hear the time of the graduate school, it's quite nice. You can look back on
it. Well, and coursework in particular. You know, I was TAing, but it wasn't a huge burden. Mm-hmm. I also actually waitered a little bit during my MA as well, but you know, that was evenings. So it was just a lot of fun.
Cool. All right. So, you know, having crafted a bit more on the philosophy of mind, what came next? Did you matriculate onto a PhD at McMaster, or what was?
No, I actually went to Western University. This is in London, Ontario. So about an hour and a half down the road, I applied to a few different places, and Western just seemed like the best fit. In part because, in addition to having an area comp, they had competency exams in history of philosophy and in logic, which I knew kind of weak in because of my 3-year undergraduate and my very selective choosing courses after that. So that ended up I think, being a really good decision for me.
So the idea being that you didn't have as much of the background in these particular subjects and would definitely get it if you went.
Exactly.
That's really bright. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Every once in a while, I actually make a really thoughtful decision that works out. Usually it's just pure dumb luck.
Well, it's interesting. I've talked to folks, philosophers of science, who are kind of in the middle ground here, who start in the sciences. And so, people have disclosed that they've, gotten into philosophy PhD programs without ever having read a word of Kant or other things.
Right.
It's good. But I think, that on the other side, there's this good emphasis on, look, it's, you don't have to maybe necessarily have a strong background in the history of philosophy, but it's not like the fact that that's not the case doesn't mean it might not help or hurt. You know what I'm saying? Like it's
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
And I still don't have a strong background in the history of philosophy, but I at least have, enough to teach introductory course in it if I need to. And, a sense of enough to put into context what colleagues who do history are doing.
Yeah.
Which I think is important, but also sufficient for what I want.
Good. I have a question I want to come back to about teaching history of philosophy, but I'll get back to that in a little bit. But what was his experience with the PhD like, and how did you come to your dissertation work?
So my program had 2 full years of coursework, including a prospectus course, which is basically a reading course around whatever the topic of your dissertation was. And at the time, I was still thinking I wanted to do something on neuroscience and mind. So I was thinking about the relationship between percepts and concepts. And, I thought that would be an interesting topic. I applied for a job working for a dermatologist writing review articles. So I told you that somebody actually did eventually pay me to write review articles. So for a long time, I knew a whole lot about fungal diseases of the skin. In fact, probably the most famous paper that I have co-written is famous because it is cited on Wikipedia in the entry on dandruff. So working with Dr. Gupta, I came across evidence-based medicine and thought it was really interesting because, of course, as a philosopher and especially somebody who is becoming increasingly interested in philosophy of science, I hear evidence-based and my ears kind of prick up and I say, well, what do you mean by evidence? What do you mean by based? So that's actually where my dissertation topic came from.
Yeah, so I noticed that evidence-based medicine is one of your strong point, one of your main research focuses. So what were some of the main questions you were asking in your dissertation research, and what did you hope to accomplish?
So at the time, there was almost no work done by philosophers on evidence-based medicine. There's a 2000 paper by John Worrell, and then he followed up with something else related, I think. And I think this was even before Nancy Cartwright started writing about stuff, but by the time I finished my dissertation, she had also done some work in that. So a lot of the work that I was doing was trying to figure out what was philosophically interesting about EBM, evidence-based medicine. And when I took my prospectus course, my supervisor, I'm sure I must have just driven him absolutely batty because I would come in and I'd be like, well, I read all this weekend. Here's what I think I want to do for my dissertation. And then the next week I'd come in and I'd say, I've been reading this and here's what I think is going on. And
he
was incredibly patient and would ask me questions that, a couple of months later, I would actually realize how important that question was and why I didn't really understand at the time, why this was such an important thing to be thinking about. So I had a really good experience. My supervisor was John Nicholas, and he had no particular interest, I guess, in philosophy of medicine. I mean, it certainly wasn't an area that he was really researching or teaching in, but he had an interest in a pragmatic approach to philosophy of science. And so I had taken a course with him on that. And we read a few things that were sort of vaguely relevant to clinical trials. And so I ended up writing a paper for him about something vaguely related to Bayesian statistics versus frequentist statistics. I don't know, that was a while ago. And he agreed, I think probably largely on that basis, to supervise my dissertation. So the dissertation writing was far from linear. I actually defended my prospectus about 5 months before I defended my dissertation, because I pretty much had to write the dissertation to figure out what I wanted to say. I wanted to do, which is actually fairly characteristic of my writing in general. So that was, it was nice to have success with that kind of blundering approach early on.
I think there's that. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's obvious. I think that's come to know that folks are aware of that and how successful it can be.
Yes.
But yes, okay. So, well, that's really interesting. What maybe could you share? What are some of the, what do you find to be particularly philosophically interesting about evidence-based medicine?
So, evidence-based medicine, the name rhetorically is just fantastic, right? Because, of course, the obvious question is, well, what were they basing it on before? But, of course, the whole point is that they have a very particular idea of what counts as good evidence. And a lot of the really good things that the EBM movement has done is it's increased the quality of reporting of clinical trials. It has made people a lot more aware of the quality of the trials themselves. The main sort of epistemological claim is that you can rank clinical evidence on a hierarchy, which they actually call a hierarchy of evidence, but it's really actually a hierarchy of methods, in that the randomized controlled trial is the gold standard, and then above that on the hierarchy are systematic reviews and meta-analyses of randomized trials, and then below the randomized trials are non-randomized studies, and then below that there's physiological studies and case reports. The really strong claim of EBM, which people do sometimes make, is that if there are randomized studies and non-randomized studies, you throw out everything but the top tier of evidence. And again, that's a fairly strong version, and most people don't subscribe to it, but people have actually said that this is the case. They've gotten more subtle in their thinking, because newer versions of the hierarchy build in issues not just of evidence, but of the quality of the actual trial. So they don't sort of make randomization the primary characteristic. They actually have a more well-rounded way of assessing study quality. So what I ended up writing about was the limits of randomization, and about the relationships among the different kinds of studies in the hierarchy. So I had one chapter where I talked about the things that non-randomized studies can do that randomized studies more or less can't. And then another chapter where I talked about, I drew a bit on the literature on mechanisms in philosophy of science to sort of think about what mechanisms might look like in a medical theory.
So, very nice. I think that's really interesting, the way in which this hierarchy is supported and justified. I imagine you've come to find some, pretty good reasons to not, take this hierarchy as epistemically justified as people might think it to be. What do you have to say in terms of this hierarchy?
So I do think that on balance, EBM has done a lot of really good things, but I think that, in part through the fault of its developers, and in part through the fault of the developers in the way that they communicated EBM, but also in the way that they conceived of the hierarchy, that they really have limited medicine in some important ways. there's been an interest in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years on what get called learning healthcare systems, which try to integrate clinical research into a clinical practice context. And I think that there's a lot of really good epistemological and ethical reasons to be trying to do that, because you get, I think, much richer evidence than you can in standard randomized trials. So I'm not sure whether that answered your question, because I sidetracked from the question in the first place.
No, sure, that's fine. Well, it sounds to me like good things are happening in terms of the people. You even talk about people discussing in these more subtle, nuanced ways. There's this almost like a canon of EBM that people are continue to be discussed and taught in base biology courses, history of medicine courses, or maybe not history of medicine, but you know what I'm saying? Like I'm co-teaching this, history of disease course where EBM is, you know, there's a particular way and it's not talked about in such a philosophically rigorous way in relation to its, share some of the things in which folks are learning. For example, it's a course on the history of tuberculosis and treatment, and there's a particular way in which EBM is discussed, and how I suppose there are, certain ways, more specifically, like cases where we didn't have randomization at this time point or something like that, or we didn't have like Koch postulates or something like that, which was, and now we do. I think at a certain point, EBM has, there's not further, this is an introductory class, mind you, but there's be interesting to see what further is discussed and developed. So what came next? How do you end up with your first job?
That was a long, slow process again as well. So in addition to working with a dermatologist for a couple of years, I ended up doing some neuroimaging research during my doctorate. A friend of mine from my undergraduate neuroscience degree had gone to med school and then arrived in London to do her residency in psychiatry. So through her, I met some of her colleagues, and they were doing imaging research, and I was really interested. So I started hanging out with them and doing some work there. As I was finishing my doctorate, the person who mentored my friends he was granted a research chair that came with funding for a postdoc. So he suggested that I apply and hired me. So I spent 3 years doing neuroimaging in psychiatry.
Oh, wow.
And being on the job market. Peter had asked me to commit to 2 years, which I did, which was really great. And he kept me on for a third when I was still job hunting. So I was able to do that. And I taught a little bit in the philosophy department. I taught a bioethics class for a couple of years.
So this is the connection. So yeah, so as you know, as listeners haven't known, I met Robin at it's a philosophy of psychiatry meeting, correct?
Association for the Advancement of Philosophy and Psychiatry. And I always have to think about how those letters work out. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So great. So I imagine this is kind of where the transition into issues in psychiatry came about.
Yeah. This was sort of my first introduction to, I had in the back of my mind that I would be interested in evidence-based psychiatry, but I thought that looking at EBM in my dissertation was a good first step to that. And then the other thing, of course, was that it let me get back into neuroscience again, which was actually super cool.
Great. Yeah. So, this is really fantastic. How did you enjoy your time as in the postdoc and kind of getting back into the science?
I really enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed doing the data analysis and sort of thinking about the various steps that go into analyzing the data and the kinds of assumptions that were being made. Because, of course, by that time, I really was, thinking like a philosopher of science.
Yeah.
And imaging is really interesting because, in a way, especially sort of the older techniques get a really bad rap because, you know, the data have to be cleaned so much to, you know, warp the individual brain to a template brain so that you can make group level inferences. You smooth the data to improve the signal to noise ratio. And so a lot of people who have criticized neuroimaging have done so because the worry is that, you know, the data has essentially been warped out of any resemblance to what's going on in the brain.
Sure.
I think there's something to those criticisms, but I also think that, you know, by this point, there's enough evidence that, you know, fMRI and PET really are measuring something. The question is, you know, how we interpret what that something is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, mm-hmm. No, that's an interesting, yeah, that's an interesting take. And I think those are the right questions to ask. So, you know, going into your postdoc, I mean, was this were ideas of, well, maybe now I want to, you know, apply for some, you know, be eligible or apply for some like science based tenure track positions, or was philosophy still kind of the main?
Still definitely philosophy. Okay. I wouldn't really have been qualified with a PhD.
Sure, that makes sense. Yeah.
And I also, even at the time, I mean, I thought about actually doing a PhD in neuroscience, but I did know that I wanted to do philosophy. And also, to have a tenure track science position, it seemed to me you spend a lot of your time writing grants and managing. Yeah. Lab assistants and, you know, other people get to do all the fun stuff. Whereas in philosophy, you know, it's just me and a book and a pen and coffee. And that, you know, is where the fun stuff actually happens.
And fortunately enough, scientists are pretty friendly when it comes to if you want, well, you know, as you found, you know, coming to work on projects. So if you actually want to do bench work, you know, you're not going to be invited into every lab, but you could find someone who would be willing to, you could do some work with, even as a tenured philosophy professor.
Right. And I'm actually a little bit jealous of the grad students at Western now, because after I left, they started a program where they embed philosophy grad students with an interest in neuroscience in labs, so that they do get that experience. And talking to some of the faculty members and some of the students who have been involved in that program, both the scientists and the philosophers find that it's really helpful for the projects that they individually want to do. I just think it's absolutely fantastic that they're doing it.
That's fantastic. I'll have to look into that. That sounds, that's a really great opportunity for these graduate students. I know there's a conference coming up at the Center for Philosophy Science on Learning from Empirical Approaches that's looking for these kinds of projects, like folks embedded projects or whatnot. So
is this Pitt? I think I saw that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's folks that do, you know, sociological methods research, but also those that, you know, place individuals in the labs themselves to like do work. So yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so then the long and slow process, I imagined, came to fruition after the postdoc.
Yes. So finally, in my third year of my postdoc, I started getting some interviews for tenure track positions in philosophy, and I took a job at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, in Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And prepared to move to the U.S.
Oh, wow.
Be a real life grown up philosopher.
Yeah. How was that transition?
It was great, actually. I was really lucky. They were able to hire my husband, partner at the time, who we met when I was at McMaster. He was starting his PhD there. When they posted my job, the AOSs were bioethics or philosophy of mind, and I could credibly claim to do both. Mm-hmm. But they were also trying to, they were also thinking very seriously about posting the job in epistemology. So David got to be the bonus epistemologist. He had a lecturer position for a couple of years, and then they were able to hire him tenure track. So he and the cat and I.
That's amazing.
Drove down to Virginia and settled in.
Yeah, I heard this. I heard the cat in the background. I imagine.
Oh, that's a different cat
now. I imagine. Yes. Yeah, I know. It's been a while. Yeah, so I didn't want to say.
Sorry. You're lucky, actually. We're not using video because I made the mistake of showing him one of those bird videos for cats once. And now every time there's a video on, he's convinced it's for
him. He's like, oh, my gosh, I get to go see it.
That's right.
That's really
sweet. Not a bird.
Yeah, that's really great. And so I should also, yeah, so what's it been like, with a partner in philosophy as well?
People often, when they hear about this, say, oh, you must have really interesting dinner table conversations. I think they're giving us too much credit. I mean, we do talk about what we're working on. We have, on several occasions, said, oh, you know, we should read this book together. And then we never managed to make time to do it. But yeah, I mean, normally we talk about teaching, we talk about the cats, we talk about how long it's been since we've managed to go and get groceries.
Yeah. There's something else to life other than philosophy as well. And so.
Yes. And I mean, I think one of the nice things is having a partner who is in the same field. You know, you just understand what it's like for the other person, you know, the sort of the rhythm of the end of the semester being ridiculously busy and the summer being much lighter. I mean, that it's helpful not to have somebody who's on a very different sort of schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. It's tough. I mean, if you were, you know, with a partner, with someone who didn't, you know, it's definitely different than a traditional 9-to-5, or it can be. I completely agree with you. Okay. So at Old Dominion, how long were you teaching there?
7 years.
Oh, great. What was your experience there?
It was really good. The department is, not a bad size, but not huge. There is no graduate program, though there's an MA in humanities. Mm-hmm. And so we offer graduate versions of our fourth year courses. That said, I never had a graduate student work with me. Well, I did, I guess, once in my last year, but that was an independent study anyway. And I taught a lot of bioethics, which I really enjoy doing. So,
Great. So how did you get into bioethics?
Accidentally. I think, you know, one of the things about philosophy of medicine is that the philosophy of medicine that's developed in the past couple of decades has been very careful to distinguish itself from bioethics. It's, we're more interested in metaphysics and epistemology, though I and a lot of other people also think a lot about the ethical implications about epistemological approaches. I do think of bioethics as being something that's quite different and really interesting for its own sake because it's so interdisciplinary. I think I first co-taught a bioethics summer class at Western with one of the other grad students. And then, these were full-year courses, so I got to teach one either in my last year of my doctorate or during my postdoc. That's just something that I sort of fell into. I actually also in grad school worked for a while with some people who were trying to develop a hub for bioethics within Southwestern Ontario, and then went from there to be a research assistant for Jeff Nisker, who is a OBGYN who taught bioethics in the med school at Western. And so it always was kind of threading through the other things that I was doing.
Oh, that's great. So, yeah, but it was, so I imagine it was really more so accidentally kind of coming in once you, like, were you working on bioethics projects during graduate school?
No, not at all.
Oh, great. Great. do you have a particular project or a paper that you really like, bioethics wise?
So here's the part where I have to put in a plug for the International Journal of Feminist Approaches to Bioethics, which I am
fantastic.
Co-editing with my colleague Jamie Nelson and former colleague Hilda Lindemann and Jackie Leach Scully at Newcastle. So I, even before being invited to join this team, have always thought that feminist bioethics was particularly interesting and particularly promising as an approach to thinking about ethical issues. Mm-hmm. So I published a couple of papers in IJFAB while I was at Old Dominion. And one of them that I really like, because it probably comes the closest to bringing together a bunch of different things that I'm interested in, looks at the question of why there are such stark gender differences in depression rates from the perspective of feminist ethics. So a lot of people, and this actually relates to another project that I did, a lot of people who want to find neuroscience explanations for sex differences or gender differences in emotion want to say that, you know, women are naturally more emotional than men, and this is why women are more prone to depression and to anxiety. And I don't have a lot of patience for that kind of sloppy thinking.
Understandable.
And so I tried to offer an explanation that took into account differences in gender socialization, but didn't just also make women sort of victims of oppressive gender norms, that tried to preserve some agency for them.
So that's fantastic. Yeah, we we discussed a little bit of this. I'm taking a Principles of Psychopathology course in which we discussed borderline personality disorder.
And, interesting.
Yeah, and some of the issues have been the much higher prevalence rates in women,
right.
And then some of the pointed critiques that show, well, again, personality disorders are one of the probably least understood, at least in terms, well, at least biologically understood, but just I would say least understood in general of mental disorders. And I think there's some interesting thoughts there. We didn't go too much into it. It was just a psychology course, but it's interesting to think about. So teaching at Old Dominion, what brought about the shift in the transition to Michigan State?
Again, pure dumb luck.
Yeah.
So the job that I was hired for was an AOS in philosophy of neuroscience. And I think part of the reason that people were interested in my application in particular was that I have an approach to philosophy of neuroscience that is very informed by social and ethical issues, especially the work that I've done on sex difference research in neuroscience, the combination of philosophy of science and bioethics. So I described the job as being essentially the job that I would have created for myself if I could dream up the perfect job for me. I like the AOS. I love having the joint appointment. Again, it was just really, really lucky that they were hiring.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned just previously other folks have, and maybe this isn't exactly the distinction, but have described trying to separate philosophy of medicine from bioethics, or I can imagine like philosophy of science with focus on philosophy of medicine from bioethics. So
right.
When you talk about a combination of the two, how do you go about doing that?
I think of myself as primarily being a philosopher of science.
Okay.
And I think that because I am interested in the ethical implications of epistemological choices made by researchers or made by the EBM folks, mm-hmm. that having a strong background in bioethics is really helpful for that. I think that, I'm currently coordinating the bioethics minor at MSU, and I realize more and more how much I appreciate how interdisciplinary that field is. And I tend to see bioethics and things that other people are doing that they would not describe as bioethics.
That's interesting.
Describe as sociology of medicine or anthropology of medicine.
Sure.
I tend, I think, generally to not deal well with the sort of disciplinary or subdisciplinary boundaries. I just tend not to see them for myself.
Good. Okay. It allows you to do much more work.
Also, I think more informative work
and also more work in general. Great. And so, what are some of the projects that you're most excited about now, for the past 3 years or currently, as a philosopher of science?
The past couple of years have been kind of an interesting period for me in terms of research, in part because of switching jobs and having courses to prepare and, you know, getting used to a new university. But also because a few years ago, everybody started publishing handbooks in philosophy of medicine. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to contribute to a few of them. So that's been a lot of my writing. I think these are really valuable projects to do, and I've enjoyed them. But it's meant that I've really spent a lot of time sort of thinking about the big picture of things that I have been doing. And now my next challenge is going to be to figure out what I want to do next. I'm actually contributing to the glut of handbooks myself. Co-editing a companion to Philosophy of Psychiatry. So that's one of the big things that I'm doing at the moment. And then I have a couple of papers that have been sort of lingering that I would like to finish. And then I want to just sort of read some things and try to figure out where I want to go next. And I have some vague ideas, but, you know, as I said earlier about my dissertation, it took me forever to be able to articulate what I wanted to do. So I have no plan.
Okay.
I have a vague direction.
Well, you can kind of barrel along and, things have come up and things will come.
Oh, yeah. I'm not worried about being bored or not having things to think about. I'm just not yet.
It's not like you have this very structured linear plan of like, okay, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. I'm just curious about you mentioned that there was this kind of emphasis on writing handbooks. How did you think this kind of came about what do you see as the benefit for these more edited volumes?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in philosophy of medicine in particular, there really haven't been any in the past because the field really just sort of, there was some philosophy of medicine going on in the 70s, but it seemed to kind of spin out into debates about whether it was philosophy of medicine or philosophy in medicine or philosophy and medicine. And they never really got traction on, you know, what the problems were.
This happened in cognitive science as well. Exact same questions.
And I think in part because of innovations in medicine itself, like evidence-based medicine, some of the big data stuff, precision medicine, there's just been more more interesting things that I think have a natural fit with philosophy. So instead of worrying about what we were doing, we just did things. And then, you know, it got to the point where there was just enough really interesting work going on that it was worthwhile to put together something that surveyed the field. And I think that the handbooks are really good. I've sort of heard from various people that they can use them to teach, because often they're sort of a nice entry into an area. So I think that is one thing that makes them valuable. I think that grad students or philosophers who are coming to a new field for the first time, it's nice to sort of have one-stop shopping to see, you know, what the big picture is. And I think, you know, at some point they're going to be interesting as historical documents as well, just see what people were thinking about during these couple of decades and, you know, how much that might be similar or different in another 20 or 50 years. So I don't know.
All good reasons. Yeah.
I think that would be really kind of fun to be around for.
Have you enjoyed writing handbook, you know, kind of the chapters as opposed to more traditional articles?
I actually enjoyed both. It was really interesting to sort of try to articulate what's compelling or what's interesting about various areas of philosophy of medicine in a way that is both rigorous and accessible. So it's kind of a nice challenge to get to try to do that.
Okay. All right. So, well, I'm looking forward to this companion in philosophy of psychiatry. And
thank you.
Very excited to see that. And okay, yeah. So you have a bunch of projects, but nothing firmly yet that you'd like to discuss.
I have a reading list that I keep adding to.
Good.
and we'll just see what happens there.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I guess we can get to our last question. Then we can open up things for anything you want to discuss or plug or whatnot. But what is the greatest challenge you think facing philosophy of science today?
I've sort of been thinking about that ever since you said that this was going to be a question. And honestly, I think that this is a great time to be doing philosophy of science. I think if I had been a grad student in the 1960s faced with writing a dissertation about white tennis shoes and confirmation, I'd be doing something else. But the fact that we're, able to work with scientists and talk to scientists and, the practice turn, looking at what scientists are actually doing and the relationship with ethical and social issues. I mean, I think that there's just a lot of really exciting work going on in general. Mm-hmm. And I think that the greatest challenge isn't a challenge for philosophy of science. It's a challenge for the humanities and for science we are, as academics, as people interested in understanding the world, in a position where we have to justify why that is worth doing. And so in some ways, in maybe a naive and idealistic way, I think that philosophy of science is actually a field that could potentially be kind of the thin end of the wedge in making an argument like that. Though I guess that also depends on people being receptive to science itself.
Sure. But I see what you're saying. I mean, there's calls for understanding from just the complexities of science and how I'd like to see that metaphor carved out and argued for. I think that would be really nice. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. Okay. Well, Robin, we've learned a lot. We've talked a lot about some of your main works and, things, coming to be a philosopher of science, philosopher of medicine, bioethicist. Is there anything you'd like to share or talk? We didn't talk much about your teaching or kind of what you're up to, but, is there anything you'd like to discuss?
No, I can't really think of anything. I think we've covered just about everything I've done with my life in the past 30 years.
Well, it's hard to cover in the first hour. I mean, there's so many things, and obviously we fit this into this kind of self-constructed narrative, but it's been really great to see, your experience, as many of us, from what I can recall, is, starting out not, being generally passionate and interested in learning and learning about particular aspects of the world, be it the humanities, be it the sciences, not totally sure how to make it fit. And you've been successful at creating your own path and finding a position that works for you. And I think is really meaningful. And especially, I really love the idea of connecting, combining philosophy of science and bioethics and being able to do work without such rigid boundaries. I think that's really something.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm having a great time, and I realize I'm just ridiculously lucky to be able to to sort of make it up as I go along.
Sure, sure. Are there any fun conferences you're thinking of attending this year, or
So I'm going in a couple of weeks to a medical epistemology conference in Cologne, in Germany. And I'm really looking forward to that. The program looks fascinating, and I'm going to get to see some people that I don't see very often and meet some people that I have only ever really known through email or through reading their paper.
Great.
So that's going to be a lot of fun.
That's great.
And then I'll come back and I'll finish my grading.
Yeah, of course, of course. All right. Well, thank you, Robin. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning. Good luck with the rest of the semester. Have fun at the conference. And yeah, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. And good luck with the rest of your semester as well. And thank you again for doing the podcast series. I think it's really fantastic.
Of course, of course. I'm more than happy to do so. All right. Talk to you soon, Robin.
Okay. Bye.